These are schools where the mantra you hear is no excuses. You know, it doesn't matter. You have 38 children in the class in September. You don't have enough materials. Children come to school hungry. No excuses for you or for the children. It's not as nice to be a child in these schools. So apart from inequity and future opportunity in life, it's also sort of, to me, it's robbing an awful lot of kids of what I think should be a natural entitlement of childhood in the richest country in the world, which is just some unrestricted sense of happiness and well-being.
That's Jonathan Kozel, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Jonathan Kozel on humanizing public education. The Austrian-born economist Friedrich von Hayek may be the intellectual godfather of neoliberalism, present-day right-wing economics. His book, The Road to Serfdom, is considered to be the Bible of anti-government free market ideas and the privatization of just about everything. From war to prisons, a core goal of neoliberalism is let the private sector do it. And there are few bigger targets than public education. The 50 million students who attend public schools are viewed as products and commodities. Under the banner of choice, the regime in Washington, according to Diane Ravitch, NYU professor, wants to shrink the Department of Education with the ultimate goal of getting rid of it entirely. The neoliberals want cuts in the education budget for public schools and more taxpayer money to go to charter schools and to vouchers for private and religious schools. Our guest today is Jonathan Kozel. For decades, as a public school teacher and author, he has documented inequities in the U.S. education system. He won the National Book Award for Death at an Early Age. His other books include Amazing Grace, Illiterate America, and The Shame of the Nation. He spoke at St. Bonaventure University in St. Bonaventure, New York. And now, Jonathan Kozel.
How many teachers are in this room? I'm so glad. I always feel safer when I'm in a room with lots of teachers. I think the teaching is a beautiful profession. And when I say teaching, you know, I'm not speaking at the expense of university scholars, but I mean classroom teaching. I mean teaching young children. It doesn't get much respect these days. There's been a sort of national wave of contempt for the classroom teacher, orchestrated usually by people who aren't teachers, typically people in the business world, or nothing about children, and probably wouldn't survive for 7 minutes in any first grade in America. All they know is the GNP, you know, and GDP and GNP, as though children, the only value children have is the, in a possible future contribution to our nations. What's the phrase they always use? To sharpen our nation's competitive edge in the global marketplace. I've never met a first grader who had the least concern about that issue. But, you know, I think teachers at their best are not just, they're not just people who hammer skills into the children's heads, though those skills are important. They're not just technicians of proficiency. At their best, they're also warriors for justice. They're like the frontline soldiers in the struggle for democracy. And I just admire all of you who do this tremendously. I'm 80 years old, but if I have the strength, I'd just love to go back and do it all again. I think human beings are at their best when they're about 6. I think it's all downhill after that. So I've been on a long downward slope, 74 years. I've spent almost my entire grown-up life working among the poorest of poor children. I started out in 1964 in the deeply segregated public schools of Boston, Massachusetts, and I might add they're still deeply segregated today. I knew nothing about teaching. I had majored in English at Harvard. The first time I ever taught, they sent me into kindergarten. I was absolutely terrified. I just had no idea what you do with little people that sized. To me, they were like gerbils, you know. And you just let them crawl all over me. But I survived. And I survived. And so they promoted me to fourth grade. And then they put me in this school, which was really, you know, something that Charles Dickens could have described. It was just heartbreaking. It was physically repellent place, just ugly place. And, you know, when we talk about equality, sometimes we never talk about aesthetics. But I think they count too. You know what I mean? I think beautiful surroundings tell children that we love them. And I think beautiful surroundings also refine the souls of children. I think ugly settings coarsen their mentalities. And this was ugly. My students, by the way, had also had a run of subs before me. This was common in those schools, and this is still common in a lot of schools. Rochester is facing this problem today. They're putting in people who don't have college degrees yet to take classes because they don't pay well enough to compensate really great teachers who will stay in the schools. They also have instability at the top, and that's bad. Rochester's had, I can't count it, something, any of you from Rochester? Am I right? Something like 5 superintendents in the past 6 or 7 years? Having classroom instability is worse because, you know, do any of you remember what it's like when you have one sub? Don't the kids tend to go wild because they think, well, we can fool her. She doesn't know what we're really supposed to do. Imagine my students had 12 subs before me. I was put in October. And the same group had had a chain of temporary teachers the previous year also. It took a long time for me to win them over because they didn't trust me at first. You know, was I going to abandon them as well? There was a lot of tension at first. What troubled me most, apart from all the other inequities, was that we had a really strict standardized curriculum. You know, nowadays that's a big deal, right? The past 15, 20 years have to have everything standardized. The people who have done this, the school reformers, as they're called, think they've invented something new. Now, they just reinvented a boring old thing that we had 50 years ago. And the trouble in Boston was that these were all black kids, almost all black kids, and there wasn't a single piece of writing that had anything to do with black authors or with their culture. So I wasn't terribly radical, but one day I just went over to a bookstore in Cambridge and I picked out a brand. Also, most of the books were old in the classroom, and they had marks on them and everything. So I picked out an expensive new hardcover book. You know, I just thought that in itself would appeal to them. Something that, you know, that nice ink smell of a beautiful new book. But it was the collected poetry of Langston Hughes, probably the best known African American poet of that period, and a pretty great poet, just whatever his ethnicity, you know. And I brought it into class. And something really dramatic happened. This was in June. It took me a long time to get the courage to do anything decent and to get my nerve up. And even before I opened the book, there was a photo of the poet on the front. And Langston Hughes was a striking looking young man. He looked like Denzel Washington when he was a little younger. Even before I opened the book, you could have heard a pin drop in the room because the kids could see the cover. And a little girl in the front row, I remember, whispered to a girl next to her and said, "Look," she said, "that man's colored." Because they said colored in those days, you know. "That man's colored." Then something really interesting happened. There was one student in the class who was had been really edgy towards me all spring. She was a little taller than the other kids. She was the same age. These were fourth graders. But she looked more grown up. She was kind of tall and very dignified looking and had a very strong face, a strong look in her face. But she didn't like me, and she sat in the back row, just as far from me as she could be. I said 35 kids in that class, by the way. She just glared at me, like she gave me that look. If you've ever seen famous poster of Malcolm X, it was like that, you know, like I was the devil. I was the ultimate white devil or something. And she really glared at me and all year. When I read that poem, it was one of the greatest moments of my life, and I didn't really think it through. I didn't do anything to deserve it. She got out of her chair. She stood up in the back row, and she quietly walked around the whole class, came up to the front, came right up to me, and she gently stroked my shoulder slightly in a friendly way, and she just whispered, "Thank you." And then she said, "Could I bring that book home and show it to my mother?" I was so happy, wouldn't you have been? I would have given her my car if she'd asked for it. And the next day, she came in. I never have asked children to memorize poetry because I think that's a way of making them hate it. But she'd memorized it on her own, and she asked if she could stand up and read it to the class. I read several poems to the kids, but the one that she memorized was a famous one that asked this question: what happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or does it explode? And she had the class in tears. And the next day I was fired from the Boston Public Schools because that poem wasn't in the standards for fourth grade. It turned out it was a sixth grade poem. That's what they told me. They said it was inflammatory for fourth graders. They couldn't handle it. Any poem by any black author would have been considered inflammatory. It's a very gentle and beautiful poem. But it was a big deal in Boston, I'll tell you. The press picked it up because it startled them. At the school committee, the school department would do something so dumb and obviously racist. I mean, they could have fired me because I was late sometimes. They could have found some good way to get rid of me. But they handed this issue to not just black folks, but almost anybody with any sense of ethics or aesthetic taste. And, you know, the headline was Rhodes Scholar Fired from Fourth Grade. The formal charge against me was curriculum deviation. Deviation. It made me more popular socially, because up till then, my friends thought I was too dull to be deviant in any way at all, you know. And the strange way our country works, the federal government was different in those days. This was the era of a president named Lyndon Johnson, who started the war on poverty. And I was fired for curriculum deviation. I was hired 1 month later by the federal government for curriculum development. And I helped to write the first English curriculum for a program which didn't have a name yet, which is called Upward Bound, which now still exists today. And I went on. I was then hired to teach in one of the progressive suburbs of Boston, a wealthy neighborhood where I had 18 children in a class instead of 35. And I was in a happy school where the principal said, yes, teach them the skills, but don't forget to smile. And she said, if you're not happy, the kids won't be happy. Think of that when you're a teacher, you know, a wonderful principal. And where they spent about twice as much for every child as they spent in Boston. And I've gone on in one way or another and been working with low-income children ever since. For most of the past 20 years in a section of New York City called the South Bronx, Mott Haven, it's a section of the Bronx, which was, when I started, and still is today, the single poorest urban congressional district in the country. I like to be an optimist, so I wish I could stand here this evening and tell you there's been dramatic progress since then. But it wouldn't be the truth. The savage inequalities in funding between wealthy and poor districts have not diminished with the years, and in many states have quite dramatically increased. I try to be very careful. I don't like to condemn any one state in particular, but New York, you know, is New York State is right up there near the top in terms of separate and unequal education, and it's notoriously unequal. We won a big court victory about 15 years ago. We sued the state to equalize funding, and we won in court, and they issued orders to the governor and legislature, and they've never followed through on the commitment that was made. Now, I have wealthy friends in New York City, naturally, you know. People who knew me might have been in college with me, or children of my Harvard classmates who now, you know, in their 50s probably and 40s. They work in New York City. They typically live in lovely towns like Manhasset or Chappaqua, Great Neck, so forth. And some of their suburban schools will spend $30,000 for every child every single year. And typically they'll have maybe in third grade, maybe 18 kids in a class. Gets much higher than that. The parents get worried. When their kids are in their teenage years, many of them aren't even satisfied by their super expensive public high schools, and they'll send their kids off to these elegant New England prep schools. Do you know what I mean by that? I live not too far from two of those famous prep schools. One's called Andover, Phillips Academy, Andover. Another, Exeter. I know those schools very well. Those schools cost about $60,000 a year now. So, you know, some of my friends have two kids at places like Exeter. They spend $120,000 a year. The thing is, these people still like me, and they still invite me to dinner at their home. But they're kind of nervous with me. You know, they're afraid I'm going to ruin the dinner party, that I'm going to say something horrible. But I'm polite, you know. I save it for dessert. I wait till the coffee and the creme brulee, and I let them have it. But the thing is, I mean, I'm gentle about it, but when I tell them about kids who go to underfunded schools with overcrowded classrooms, often with old, outdated books and software, buildings in disrepair, classes sometimes is way over 30. I in New York last year, I said to an audience of teachers, classes sometimes over 30, and some of the teachers said, I have 38 right now. All these conditions for the kids who need the help most. I'll describe this, and these friends of mine who probably think they're liberals, certainly call themselves liberals, they'll look at me and they'll say, Jonathan, you know how much we care. I'm never sure I do, but they say, you know how much we care. But just tell me one thing, and then they'll look me right in the eyes and they'll say, can you really solve these kinds of problems by throwing money at them? And I always say, I don't know. It seems to work for your kids, doesn't it? What's at stake? What's at stake there? What's missing in their ethical formation that they... Now, when they say, can you really solve this problem by throwing money at it? I always say, yes. That's a great way to do it. That's the best way I know. Throw it. Dump it from a helicopter. Give it to me. I'll bring it there myself. I don't know. A better way of giving a principal the opportunity to divide big classes into two intimate smaller classes by hiring, you know, twice as many teachers. And I won't go on with this, but I have deep feelings about this. And it's heartbreaking to me because, you know, it's easy to be critical of in states where the governor or legislators might be extreme right-wing people, but this happens even in states where the governmental leaders seem to be really earnest, compassionate people. Briefly, I'll say, on top of this, for anyone my age, it's also kind of heartbreaking to see the sweeping resurgence of racial isolation in our public schools. According to the Civil Rights Project at UCLA, those of you who are familiar with this issue will know what I'm referring to. Probably the most authoritative group of experts on segregation. Black and Latino children are more isolated right now physically in their public schools than any time since 1968, the year when Dr. King was taken from us, ironically. Now, I'm old enough, so I remember Dr. King. I guess it was the end of the year, in the end of 1960, the spring of 65, might have been 1 year later, when Dr. King finally came to speak in Boston. He spoke at a big outdoor rally at a historic spot called Boston Common, which was a scene of revolutionary battles. One of those mass rallies, black leaders asked me if I would like to walk with him, with them, but escorting him, and be like a bodyguard to Dr. King. I mean, look at me. I was just a skinny dweeb, but it was an act of solidarity. And, you know, I remember his voice. I remember his eloquence. I remember the perspiration pouring down his brow. Always had a handkerchief here so he could mop his brow. And I remember his words. I remember his dream. You know, nowadays, a lot of politicians like to say, you know, yes, we're fulfilling the dream or something like that. Politicians who never lifted a finger to deal with racial isolation, they always say this. And I always wonder what they think the dream was. I mean, Dr. King did not say, I have a dream that someday in the divided cities of the East and West and North and South, we will have anxiety-ridden, test-driven, rigidly disciplined, slightly higher scoring, separate and unequal public schools. That was not his dream. Dr. King's dream was clean and pure. I have a dream, he said, that someday little black children and little white children will sit at the table of brotherhood together. I don't know if I'll live to see it happen, but I hope some of you will try with all your hearts to make that dream at last a tangible reality. It's not just the physical isolation that's so troubling today. It's another fact that in certain ways divides us even more. Over the past 15 or 20 years, there's been a kind of what I call a line of demarcation drawn between two very different kinds of education, depending largely on the economic level and sometimes also the race of the children that we serve. Two really different kinds of pedagogies. In the very privileged, very affluent suburban schools, the legacy of wise, enlightened, child-centered education is still alive and well. It's been eroded somewhat by the testing pressures for children everywhere, which is why many of the affluent families opt out and keep their kids home on testing days. But by and large, these very affluent schools are still pretty benign and happy places. Driving motivation is still the love of learning for its own good sake alone, and not like the perpetual fear of failure on an exam. Children still have a chance to read good books for the joy of reading them, not to get a number pasted on their forehead. And teachers can still draw upon their creativity in preparing lessons and their sense of grace and artistry in interacting with the children in the classrooms. Still a lot of time for kids to ask questions, pursue their curiosities to unexpected destinations. No one panics if the children arrive at an outcome that wasn't listed in the Common Core, but much more interesting than anything those mediocre semi-intellectuals ever dreamt of when they wrote it. And don't imagine that Nobel Prize winners wrote the Common Core. It's pretty dreary going. I've been reading it, and many of the passages in the English language arts section would not get you a C minus in a university English course. And there's one sentence which says, "All artistic creativity consists of four separate metacognitive activities." And then it lists them. I've been writing what I thought was literature for 50 years, and I never used one of those metacognitive things. They're just thinking of big words. Metacognitive is just a big word to make you think they know something more than they do. Well, what I'm saying is there's still plenty of schools where it's still fun to be a child, and where the kids are achieving very, very well without being robbed of all the aesthetic pleasures, the whim, the humor, the merriment, the sweetness that lovely teachers can bring into the classroom. It's a different story in an awful lot of the urban schools, and maybe, you know, many of the low-income rural schools as well. I don't know them as well. But, I mean, there are exceptions, and there's also a new disciplinary agenda, highly punitive in nature, explicitly modeled. I mean, you look at the literature, and I'll say, why are you being that severe with the children? And they say, well, this is called, I'll tell you what it's called, and they do it in all the major inner cities now, not in wealthy white neighborhoods, but in for the minority kids. They call it the broken windows theory of classroom management. How many have ever heard of it? It's a model on policing strategies. Broken windows theory, that's the approach, you know, if you let small little crimes go by, if you let small misbehaviors go by, then people will commit big misbehaviors. These are schools where the mantra you hear is no excuses. You know, doesn't matter. You have 38 children in the class in September. You don't have enough materials. The children come to school hungry. No excuses for you or for the children. Another common phrase I hear all the time, there must be penalties for failure. It's not as nice to be a child in these schools. So apart from inequity and future opportunity in life, it's also sort of, to me, it's robbing an awful lot of kids of what I think should be a natural entitlement of childhood in the richest country in the world, which is just some unrestricted sense of happiness and well-being. The tough guys, the business-minded corporate guys who are dictating most of pedagogic policy these days, you know, they'll say, now you have to get tough with those kids in order to guarantee their future productivity, to make sure that 20, 30 years from they will contribute to the GDP. I don't understand why we subordinate the present tense of childhood entirely to the future possibilities of this person, you know, 20 years, 30 years later.
You're listening to Jonathan Kozel on Humanizing Public Education. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. 1977, or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
What if this little girl in first grade, whom we're drilling and killing with rote and drill instruction, testing her all the time, which is the new pedagogic version of product testing, essentially, because these same people refer to our students as the products of our schools. Did you know that? They also say that if you raise their scores, they are value-added children. That's a new term. It's all economic junk jargon. What if, you know, misfortunes happen? What if when she's 18 or 20, she gets a dread disease and dies and never gets to contribute to our nation's productivity? Wouldn't it have been worth giving her a couple of years of joy and jubilation in her years of innocence? They do this in other countries, you know. Read about Finland someday if you want to be optimistic. They are a wonderful model for us. Why are they doing this? Well, they tend to justify it this way. The people who do this, they say, Jonathan, these children are different. They're so different. You know, they come to class and their minds are chaotic and disorderly. They can't be allowed the kind of spontaneity and independent thinking that we welcome in children of the upper middle class. I don't believe it. I don't believe they're a different species, you know. I don't believe their minds are different. I don't believe their hearts are different. Teachers are under so much stress in these schools that in many of these schools, they're not using literature. They're not letting kids just enjoy really good books because they're forced to use rote and drill materials that are allegedly research-based and proven by some research to be the most efficient way to pump the scores. So in reading, for example, instead of using a combination of phonics and what I call balanced literacy, which means letting kids just revel in turning the pages of marvelous children's books to get them, create an appetite for reading, all these wonderful books are disappearing from these classrooms. I look around, I say, where is the very hungry caterpillar? Do you remember that? How many people remember that? I wouldn't want to go to school if there was no hungry caterpillar in my room. Where's the grouchy ladybug? You know, I want to see Owl. Owl was dyslexic. Do you remember that? He spelled his name W-O-L. They didn't have that word dyslexia in those days, but you can be a dyslexic without knowing it, you know. And the donkey who didn't have a tail, what was his name? Eeyore, yes. One of the great figures of tragic literature, I always think. Right up there with Hamlet and King Lear. It's all phonics in these schools, but it's not even phonics in an enjoyable and engaging way. They're sending these packaged reading systems, heavily scripted. So they don't even leave it to the teacher to use his sort of ingenuity and artistry in doing it. I believe in phonics, but there's some people who carry it to a maniacal extreme. One of the things particularly troubles me is that a lot of these heavily drill-based schools, so-called no-excuses schools, they're telling teachers, don't let the children ask too many questions, or don't let them tell you their own stories, because that'll get you way off track. And some of these principals, even good principals, they feel forced to put this pressure on the teachers, like, don't let them wander off from the standards. Because some of these school districts are being observed by the state. Do you know what I mean? Schools are, what's that term they use? They're underperforming, so they're on some kind of turnaround status or something. And so the principals are scared. And so they're telling the teachers, there's no time to let those little ones ask too many questions or indulge their curiosity. Curiosity is not going to be tested. Spontaneity is not going to be tested. delight in learning won't get you any points on the standardized exams. They don't measure delight. Delight, in fact, could be a distraction. It could keep you from reaching your objective. The trouble is that little kids want to ask their questions, and they want to tell their stories. And then the really little ones, around 5, 6, 7, especially around first and second grade, are gifted artists at subverting lesson plans. That's like a gift God gave them, you know. They wave their fingers in your face. And I visit classes like that. The teacher sometimes lets me take the class, and they wave their hands like this, you know, and they defy the laws of gravity. I don't know. They lean way out from their chairs, and there's always one right in front of me, like waving her fingers right in my eyes. She's going to poke my eyes out and makes these sounds like, ooh, ooh, ooh. So she's going to die if I don't call on her, you know. So there's the teacher, and she's, forget my role in the classroom, you know. The regular day, she's got her standard written, her objective, whatever it's called, depending on the state you're in. I've seen it in New York, something like ELA 65, children will demonstrate their proficiency to, in one classroom it was, children will demonstrate their proficiency in producing a narrative procedure. And I majored in English, and I had no idea what that means. So I asked the teacher, and he said, it just means writing a story. I said, why don't you put that on the board? I can't. He said, I'll get in trouble. She's got her stand. I'll say she, because it's usually a woman in these early grades. She's got the standard there on the chalkboard or the new electronic board, whatever they're using now. And a little child raises his hand. I'm thinking of a specific child in a classroom I used to visit. He's a little boy named Reginald. He raises his hand, and he can't control himself. He says, teacher. And she thinks, Reginald is a good old boy, and I know he likes me. Maybe he's going to help me reach my objective. I'll take a chance. So she says, yes, sweetie. See, happy teachers talk that way to their children still. He says, yes, sweetie. He says, guess what? See, they always do that. They never tell you anything. You have to guess. So she says, what? And he says, yesterday, on Sunday afternoon, my auntie and uncle took me to the zoo. And guess what? So now she thinks, she's worried she's going to lose it, but it's too late. So she says, what? And he says, and I saw a baby bear that had just been born. And they let me touch his nose, and it was wet and warm. And off he goes, you know, for one of those eternal and glorious run-on sentences, piling on the ends and buts, you know. 6-year-olds are almost as good at that as William Faulkner. And sometimes at the ends of all those ends and at the end of all those ends and buts, if you don't cut him off, there's a piece of hidden treasure where that little child unveils something deep and secret in his soul or her soul that you never knew about that child before. And good teachers use that piece of hidden treasure as a key to unlock motivation. But in a heavily test-driven school, teacher often has to cut him off. We'll never find that treasure. We'll never know what lies within that child's heart. I always, you know, beg our teachers to resist that trend with every bit of wisdom and good judgment that they have. Once we lock a child's spirit into silent stone, that child may never again dare to speak out in a voice of authenticity or spontaneity. And discouraging kids from asking questions, especially at this moment in our history, it just strikes me as particularly unwise in our democracy. If we want our children to grow up with the power and the critical audacity to make their voices heard in the face of unjust policies and to interrupt the conversation, as it were. I like that term, to interrupt the conversation, at least to interrupt the conversation of those who spread divisiveness and bigotry among us. If we want our citizens to be able to express their own convictions without inhibition, it's not in our interest or in theirs to mute their voices or suppress their lively little spirits when they're only 6 years old. You know, a lot of lip service paid to critical thinking, but real critical consciousness requires a little more toleration of impulsive spontaneity in the words of children. That's my own belief. Remember when I was trying to explain a few moments ago how these really tough, these sort of testing fanatics, these advocates of what I call Teutonic education, totalitarian education, obedience-driven education. I mean, it's really something. And there are, in a lot of inner-city schools now, they're bringing in EMOs. These are private companies. What's that stand for? Educational Management Organizations, to drill the teachers in the ways they're supposed to reconstruct the mentalities of the children to make them more obedient. And, the really severe practices. In many of these schools, they insist the child always looks relentlessly at the teacher. Can't turn your head away to smile at someone in the class, or look out the window, there's a squirrel on a tree branch or something. Yeah, no, and they'll say, the expression is tractor beams. That's reference to your eyes. Sometimes they'll make the children chant. They'll say, 1, 2, 3, eyes on me. And the children have to chant that in reverse. There'll be whole lists. In some of these schools, there's one of these companies now posts a list of 12 misbehaviors and 12 good behaviors. And at the end of every class, the teacher has to grade every child on how many of the 12 misbehaviors and good behaviors the child displayed in the preceding hour. The teachers are told not to smile, stand rigidly. Anyway, the justification is these kids have disorderly minds, you know, because they come from poor neighborhoods where there's crime in the streets, or sometimes they'll blame the parents. You know, the parents didn't do what we being the university-educated upper-middle class, what we did for our children. So they'll blame the poor parents. Instead of scapegoating the parents, there's one way we could deal with this. If we think a lot of poor folks don't have the skills they need to prepare their children socially and emotionally and academically for school, you can't turn back the clock and give those parents their childhood again. Most of them had mediocre educations. They typically went to separate and unequal schools. You can't turn back the clock 20 years. There's one thing you could do. You could give all those little kids 3 or 4 years of the best possible, wonderful, developmental preschool education before they even come to us in public school. And if we did it right, that would cut these discipline problems, these disruption problems, these so-called broken windows. That would cut that, in my belief, by 90%. It's strange we don't do this because wealthy people do it for their children. And they start them when they're 2 or 2.5 in the best preschools money can buy. And in New York City, the Upper East Side, like as in Beverly Hills and other super rich places, those pre-Ks can cost like $40,000 a year for a 2.5-year-old. That's a lot, isn't it? I mean, how much does a 2.5-year-old weigh? I always wonder, how much is that per pound? Meanwhile, in the kids I know, get almost nothing in comparison. New York State, in theory, has had a universal pre-K program for years, but it's never been observed. It's just been a deception, a piece of polite intention. But New York City is trying harder right now, thanks to Mayor de Blasio. They're trying to give every child at least 1 year, like when they're 4 years old. But it's a struggle to do it with that very limited budget. And, I go into kindergartens in big cities and small cities all the time. I'll say to the teacher, how many of these little ones had some real pre-K before they came to you? And typically, she'll look around the room and say, Jonathan, if you mean real, beautiful, developmental preschool, not drill and grill stuff, but rich Ericksonian developmental preschool education, maybe half these children got something for half a day for 1 year. Meanwhile, not just wealthy people, but even just a lot of just solid middle class folks are giving their kids 3 years or more. And who needs it most? And then they all enter public school, and guess which ones are identified as talented and gifted and set on the royal road that's going to lead to honors and AP, and which ones, on the other hand, are going to be labeled developmentally delayed. If I had the power, I would take all those multi-billions of dollars that are going right now to these huge multi-global testing corporations, and I would pour that money into 5 full years of infant care and beautiful, happy, rich, developmental preschool with wraparound packages of every kind for medical and psychological health and parent component. And I'd do that for every single child in this land. That's what I would do. I'm going to end this on a personal note, maybe sort of a note to cheer you up. I'm at an age when life increasingly seems precious. I mean, time seems precious. A lot of people I've relied upon for guidance and courage in my life have been taken from us over the past 10, 15 years. I'm thinking of one of the people who meant the most to me in education, probably the person who's influenced me more than any other educator who was living in the past half century. And it may surprise you, it was not a radical intellectual. I'm thinking of a man who I think was probably the best friend little children in America had for more than 50 years, a sweet and gentle soul named Fred Rogers. Mr. Rogers, or Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. How many of you ever watched that? Oh, I'm so glad. Look at that entire room almost. I loved Fred. Once we were in New York, we were co-speakers for the 100th anniversary of a progressive group called the American Montessori Society. It was over around 11 in the morning, and we came out on the street there in the middle of Manhattan, East Side, and he said, would you take me up to the Bronx to meet the children you've been writing about all these years? I said, oh, I'd love to do that. And he was so sweet and cautious. He said, do you think I would intimidate them? I mean, I smiled at the thought of Mr. Rogers intimidating anyone. I joked. I said, I bet they can handle it. And he said, how do you usually go? And I said, well, actually, the quickest way is by train, by the number 6 train. Any of you know New York City? You know, we were somewhere in maybe, near 50th, 60th, East Side. It's only about 7 stops or something from the richest to the poorest neighborhood in the United States, urban neighborhood. I think it's like 6 or 7 stops. So I said, the train's the quickest way. He said, okay, let's go on the subway. He liked that idea. So we went down the smelly subway together, and got on the train and went up there and got out at a stop called Brook Avenue, which it was very close to the neighborhood that I've been writing about all these years. At that time, Brook Avenue was a pretty dangerous street. It was high crime at that time. I don't want to sound like somebody in Washington who likes to talk about the carnage in poor neighborhoods, because that demonizes people. But it was a pretty dangerous street. That was the heart of the heroin trade at that time. It's better now. It was so intense, they would rent squares on the sidewalk to different dealers. You know those little squares on cement? And they'd sort of whisper to you as you went along and tell you what they were selling. So here's Mr. Rogers and I walking up the government. Very polite. But I sort of wondered, maybe nobody will know who he is. You know, maybe we're so divided now, and he looks a little older, you know, maybe nobody will recognize him. And sometimes I believe those people who say they're different. Do you follow me? If they hear it enough, you almost begin to believe it. Their mentalities are so different. You know, they can't, don't let them have the joy that suburban kids have because they're different. Maybe they won't know Mr. Rogers is baloney. A sanitation truck came screeching to a halt. A driver, a middle-aged African-American man, jumped out of the cab and lifted Mr. Rogers off the ground. Big hug. We go up to school. I never visit like the super school that gets all the media attention. There's always one school in a poor neighborhood that secretly has extra money or something, or a charter school that, without admitting it, actually cherry picks the kids they admit and sort of politely discourages kids who have special needs from enrolling, and so their scores look better. I never pick that school. I pick a regular public school that has to serve all the children, but I try to pick one where the principal is really working her heart out, and I want to give her a little shot in the arm. So I brought Mr. Rogers to a school that I liked on Brook Avenue. And I think the teachers were more moved than the little children. So the teachers had tears in their eyes. And he squeezed his bottom in those little chairs, you know, and didn't ask anyone about test scores. Asked good questions. At the end of school, we went to an after-school program that's just around the corner in a church that I've written about a great deal, and a church where the pastor is a woman, one of the first women priests in the Episcopal Church, Martha Overall, a really remarkable person. And she, if she wanted, she could have gone off and created a subtly selective charter school and used it to humiliate the public system, but she wouldn't do that. Instead, she does everything she can to support the public schools because she knows that's ultimately the future of democracy. And it's a very good program, but it was packed. Mr. Rogers and I got there a little after 3, and there were already 90 kids there. They were getting their snack. It was the first thing they do at the after school. And at the far end of the room, there was a little boy I knew named Mario. He's a sort of, I won't say plump, because he might come up to Boston and be mad at me if I say that, but he was round, I would say. He had a round face. His face looked like an olive with a smile painted on it. He was a sweet little boy. But, you know, kids like, he was 6, I think, and kids like that, if they don't like you, they can make that clear right away. But if they like you, you're in for it. And he spots Mr. Rogers, and he goes straight at him, straight across the room, and he it's like a little, his arms out like this, like a little jet-powered bumblebee, because he's a little round. And the moment of collision, he wraps his arms around Mr. Rogers, and because Mr. Rogers was sitting down. He wraps his arms around Mr. Rogers' head, and he gives him a big kiss on his forehead. He looks him right in the eyes, and he says, "Welcome to my neighborhood, Mr. Rogers." And Mr. Rogers, you know, said, "I'll never forget that little boy." He said, "Someday maybe we will invite him to our neighborhoods too." Oh, Thank you and good luck.
Thank you.
That was Jonathan Kozel on humanizing public education. He spoke at St. Bonaventure University in St. Bonaventure, New York. Jonathan Kozel is a leading educator and author. He won the National Book Award for Death at an Early Age. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Michael Parenti, Kashama Sawant, Cornell West, Chris Hedges, and Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Jonathan Kozel on Humanizing Public Education, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Anne Claire Fisher. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.